The Destiny Foundation is proud to present this special lecture by Rabbi Beryl Wine. We hope you enjoy.
There is currently a film regarding the last 12 hours of the life of Jesus that was produced by Mel Gibson in Hollywood and has caused quite a stir and probably will continue to do so for the foreseeable future. And therefore, I wanted to talk tonight to you about, let us say, our version of the events. Generally, the ideas of Judaism regarding early Christianity, how they developed, what the problems were, and how over history the problems have been exacerbated by events. The New Testament itself is composed of four different Gospels. The Gospels themselves don't agree on many things. The Gospels were written not by people who were contemporaries, but the earliest Gospel is Luke's Gospel is about the year 90. So, in effect, it's different versions of legends and hearsay. According to all of the Gospels, however, there was a man called Jesus who claimed to be the Messiah. He claimed not only to be the Messiah, he claimed to be the Son of God, and who was crucified. And all of them agreed that the crucifixion itself was performed by the Romans. However, in the Gospels, Jewish religious leaders of the time, whether they be the high priest or the head of the Sanhedrin, are implicated in handing him over to the Roman authorities and, in fact, facilitating his execution. Because according to the Gospels, Pontius Pilate, who was the Roman governor of Judea at the time, was wishy-washy about the subject. It's interesting, for a long time we didn't even know anything about Pontius Pilate, but he had found the pillar with his name on it that was excavated by archaeologists in Caesarea, which is like the first visible evidence of his governorship in Judea that we've been able to see. In any event, in English, we have a phrase, you know, to wash your hands from the matter, which means that it's really not your concern. You're not involved. You're not responsible. And that phrase is taken directly from the New Testament because Pontius Pilate is alleged to have washed his hands. And he says he leaves it up to the Jews. And the high priest and the head of the Sanhedrin are the ones that say, well, you should kill him. And they say, and what is a... what has proven to be a very difficult passage in Jewish history, they say that his blood and his murder is upon us and upon our descendants forever. That's the New Testament's version of it. Now, the Jews themselves, the Talmud, for instance, the Mishnah, which was written and composed pretty much at the time of early Christianity, has nothing to say about Christianity. Zero. Zero reference to it, zero reference to the Christian Savior. The Talmud itself, which contains, as you know, quite a few thousand pages, has less than 30 lines, even if we put back everything that was removed. It has less than 30 lines about Christianity or about Jesus in it. So we could say that the attitude of the rabbis towards Christianity was pretty much to ignore it. Not to ignore it in the sense that it wasn't there, but to ignore it in the sense that they did not feel that Christianity posed a challenge to Jews in terms of faith and belief. It posed a challenge to Jews just as the Romans and the Greeks did in terms of a dominant culture, in terms of people with power, of what they could do to Jews, but not that it would be a religion that would prove attractive to Jews. And it is safe to say that there were many more Hellenists in the period of the Hashmonaim, Jews who adopted Greek ways and became Greek, than there ever were Jews who became Christians in the early part of Christianity. The reason for that, number of reasons. Theologically, it was impossible for Jews to believe, because how can there be such a thing as the Son of God? How does God come in the form of a human body, when, according to Jewish belief, God is incorporeal, he has no relationship to any sense of space or time or form, and that all references to God in the Tanakh, so to speak, are to be taken and in an allegorical fashion, lesaber es ozen, just to satisfy our ear, but that we really know nothing about God, and we can say nothing about God, and God and you, it's not that, you know, God is a big human, or he's a nice man with a long white beard, or any of the other fantastic pictures that humans have. I think probably the greatest burst of genius in this matter is Michelangelo's painting on the Sistine Chapel, where the finger, so to speak, of God touches the finger of the human being. That's the connection. But God has no finger, and we cannot represent him that way. So how can it be that, you know, that God comes in a human form? And more than that, that the human form is allowed to be killed in an excruciatingly agonizing fashion. And the rabbi said that the rabbis went to all lengths to avoid any understanding of God in such a fashion. Therefore, for instance, the rabbis commented on the story that we have in the Chumash Bereishis, in the book of Genesis, where the story of Lot and his daughters is recorded. So you remember the story that the city of Sodom and Amorah, the cities are destroyed, and Lot and his two daughters flee, and they live in a cave. And as far as they're concerned, the whole world has been destroyed, right? The apocalypse has come. And there's nobody left. And the daughters say, Ein ish ba'aretz, asher yovo aleinu g'derech kol ha'aretz. There's no man left, right? There's nobody here. The human race is going to be extinct. And therefore, they feel that it's their duty to preserve the human race. And the only man around is their father. And therefore, they commit incest with their father. And both of the daughters become pregnant from the father and give birth to a child that was fathered by their own father. Now, in the Torah, it says that one of the children was called Moav, one of the sons. Moav literally meaning Mayov, from my father. And the second one was called Ben-Ami, Ben-Amon, from my people. It's a more guarded, shrouded reference to the fact that their father was the father of their children as well. So the rabbis point out that the daughters of Lot, why didn't they say that they were impregnated by angels? By heaven. That's something that Mishina Ex Deus, it's called. It's something that happens in the 18th century in a little town in Poland, famous incident which is recorded in all the tshuvas. So there was a woman who gave birth to a child, and her husband had been away on a trip for like 3 years. And so she claimed an angel did it. And in the 18th century Poland, people lived in a fantasy world. So it could be that an angel did do it. And there was big disputes. And in fact, for many decades or even centuries afterwards, there were groups of Jews who would not marry anyone that came from that town. Because maybe that was the illegitimate, maybe they're descended from this illegitimate person. So, but there were those that said that believed her. That the child was truly angelic. So then why didn't the daughters of Lot say that they were impregnated by angels? So the rabbis point out that's how holy that much was left within them that they would not desecrate God to say, or any heavenly thing to say, that such a thing could happen. So that was always part of the Jewish psyche. It was part of the Jewish tradition. We see also in Chumash Bereishis, for instance, at the end of Parshas Bereishis, when it describes the giants and the powerful men that were in the world then. So it says that B'nai Elohim saw the women of the world and they lusted after them and they therefore lived with them, and from these unions were born these great powerful people, the giants, etc. So you'll notice Rashi there says, one interpretation Rashi says is that the angels came down. You'll look in the Rishonim, you'll see that they really get one of the few times that they really go after Rashi tooth and nail. And therefore they're forced to say Rashi's second shot, which is what? That the noblemen, B'nai Elohim there does not mean any sort of heavenly body, but it means a nobleman, a prince, the kings, they took whatever women they wanted to. And from those unions came the sheikhs and the princes and the officers and the people that had power. And again, why were they so nervous? Because of the fact that how can we say that angels lived with women? And that's the legend of the fallen angels, which exists in Christianity. And we find it in our Medrash also. But again, most of the commentators say that's a Medrash Pliya, it's a wondrous Medrash, how could such a thing be? And they say it was inserted, it wasn't real. It's a whole discussion on it. But the discussion basically centers on this question, right? How does God appear in a human form? How does anyone associated with God, so to speak, the angels, appear in a human form? So, for instance, when the angels come to eat in the house of Abraham, so all the Mephoshim say, it looked like they ate, but angels don't eat. Again, the same idea to remove it from the possibility of attributing human behavior to heavenly creatures, certainly to God. So that was one idea of theology on the surface, immediately, would make Christianity rejected by Jews because of the fact that that concept of God never existed by us. The second problem was the question of the Trinity, that God is three, He's not one. He is one, but He's three. The mystery of the Trinity, as the Church calls it. So the rabbis didn't buy into that either. They didn't see how that type of theology could exist. And therefore, the rejection of Christianity on the threshold of Christianity was basically theological. And it remained so for a long period of time. Now, early Christians were all Jews. And they were all observant Jews. They weren't even Mizrahi. But they were believers in Jesus as the Messiah, and in this concept of the Messiah as being the Son of God, not just as being a human being. It's not for naught that when the Rambam describes the Messiah, he describes him in less than heavenly terms. He'll live, he'll die, the world isn't going to change because of it. The Rambam at the end of Hilchos Melachim is a very bland messianic era for us. The Rambam just says that they won't have to go to trials at the Hague. We'll be freed from Shibud Malchius, from the yoke. You know, you have, every time you have a policy, you won't have to call up Colin Powell and ask him, is it all right to do this? But more than that, the Rambam doesn't promise us. He doesn't say that apples of gold will fall from the tree, or he doesn't say, he says it'll be easier to make a living, right? The truth is that even today, with all the unemployment and everything, it's easier to make a living than it was in the Middle Ages. There's economic prosperity. It's not distributed evenly yet, or even fairly, but it's here. The opportunities are here. So the rabbis went out of their way to take to defame this idea, so to speak, to weaken it. And the early Christians, Peter especially, saw Christianity as Judaism, not as a separate religion. You'll hear it today from evangelists or from the Christians who call themselves Jews for Jesus, that Christianity is the fulfillment of Judaism. And it was that idea that the rabbis knocked off immediately and therefore said that our task was to separate the Christian community from the Jewish community. If you want to be Christians, they can be Christians. Most of the Forshim, even the Rambam, holds that Christianity is an advance over paganism, to step up the ladder. It's something that should not be denigrated. But it has nothing to do with us. It has nothing to do with Judaism. And the early Christians attempted to proselytize amongst Jews, and they were singularly unsuccessful. And because of that, therefore, when Paul came along at the end of the first century, Paul, who was already, Paul was an ex-yeshiva bucher, and he was from the Prushim, and he is really the man who built Christianity, much more than anyone else. Christianity is a product of Paul, much more than it is of Jesus or anyone else. And so he made it to be a world religion by divorcing it from Judaism completely, by abrogating the Old Testament is canceled. That's until Christianity, but it doesn't have effect anymore. And therefore, there's no necessity for mitzvot. Saturday is no longer the Sabbath. The requirement for circumcision for males is certainly done away with. Because these were all the problems that the converts to Judaism or the potential converts to Judaism in Roman times faced. There was a large movement of Romans, of non-Jews, that converted to Judaism in the time of the Mishnah. And some of them were leading Romans, nephews of the emperor, members of the royal household, people of the top economic and intellectual class, because they had had their fill of paganism. They didn't believe in Jupiter and all that nonsense anymore. And the values of Judaism were to them very, very attractive. And but the only thing is that in order to become a Jew, So if you were a male, you had to circumcise yourself, which was no easy matter even today, especially for an adult. And you had to accept upon yourself the yoke of the mitzvot, right? The 613 mitzvot. And you have to say you're prepared to observe all of them. Nevertheless, it's estimated that between 50 to 70,000 Romans converted to Judaism during those centuries. And we find that many of the Tannaim, 30% of the Tannaim, were either converts or descendants of converts. And we go down the list, you know, Shemai Naphtalion, Reb Tarfon, Reb Meir, oh great, Rabbi Akiva, all of them were out of this gene pool of converts that came into Judaism. But now when Paul came along and he said, so to speak, you can have the benefits of Judaism without the liabilities, right? We'll forget about the conversion, we'll forget about the mitzvahs, we'll forget about everything else. And you just have to say, I believe. So then it swept the Christian world, swept the Roman world, rather. And it became the dominant religion of the time, especially in the 4th century when the Emperor Constantine, the Roman Emperor Constantine, he and his mother Helena converted to Christianity and established the Christian Church as the official religion of the Roman Empire. And that marked the change. So The rabbis instituted the Birchas Aminim, the bracha against Jewish Christians that had to be recited, the 19th blessing of the Amida, the 18th blessing Amida. They added it. Now, the blessing in the form that we have it today, V'la Malshini Malti Sikva, has been pretty much watered down. Much of the original phraseology has been changed. Because if you read the bracha today, it doesn't say anything about anything. It says, L'malshini malti sikva, those who are traitors should not have any hope, and the Rishoyim should be destroyed, and that God should destroy evil in the world, etc. So what's wrong with that? That's universal. That applies to everyone. But originally it was much more specific and was directed towards Jewish Christians, and in the Talmud, the word min had a definite definition. The word that min referred to a Jewish Christian. And therefore the bracha was called the Birchas Haminim. The word min later came to include any Jew that was a non-believer or that was denied the God of Israel, etc. But that's later. But the word min in its original form is almost always limited to the Jewish Christians. And the rabbis were successful in separating the Jewish Christians out of Jewish society. Now, there we have recorded instances of violence between Jews and Christians over those two, three centuries. And just as we have recorded instances of violence between Jews and Jews. And you know that when you break up a shul, it's never done with smiles. And so there was this rubbing, but basically there was not a, a confrontational instinct that existed between Jews and Christians until the time of Constantine, when Constantine is the one that made it the official religion of the Romans, and then the anti-Jewish tinge of Christianity took hold. There's a book by James Carroll called Constantine's Sword, which is an excellent review of Christian attitude towards Judaism from the time of Constantine onwards and why it happened that way. The early church fathers, such as Justin Martyr and others, were bitterly anti-Jewish. Said terrible things about Jews and Judaism, and that is inculcated in the and included in the basic text of Christianity. They are the church fathers, and the Christian religious anti-Semitism became ingrained from that, became part of it, and to such an extent that it always was difficult and still is difficult to somehow attempt to separate it or to extract at least the venom from it. Now, regarding Jesus himself, so we have the famous debate of the Ramban, Rav Moshe ben Nachman, with the Jewish apostate, Pablo Cristiani, which took place in 1263 in Barcelona. And the Ramban left us a record of that debate. It's called the Sefer HaVikuach, the Book of the Debate, and Moshe Rav Kook has Rabbi Chevelle's edition of the Sefer HaVikuach. It's been reprinted many, many times. It's been translated into English as well. In fact, they even made a movie about it called The Disputation. It's been a Broadway play because it's a very fascinating thing. And the Ramban was given freedom of expression, freedom of speech by the king, by James I of Aragon. And the Ramban was a very strong debater. When the debate was over, so the king said to him, "I have never heard a wrong cause defended so ably." And not only that, the Ramban records that the king gave him 300 gold coins for the support of his yeshiva, which is an even greater testimony to the effect that the Ramban had. The Ramban, this was the week before Shavuos. The Ramban went to the synagogue in Barcelona on Shavuos, the Shabbos of Shavuos that year, and he delivered a drasha called Torah Hashem Tmima, the Torah of God is perfection, which was basically a restatement of Jewish belief. And that is also published in the same book, in Chevelle's book, in the Kitvei HaRamban, one of the most marvelous drashot, the sermons that exists in Jewish literature. And it's a restatement of the Jewish belief and the restatement of the Jewish understanding of Torah. I don't know why these things are not taught or learned in our schools, because if they were, it would strengthen our faith and it would be allow us to deal with a very hostile non-Jewish world instead of always taking the onslaught and not being able to, even many times in our own minds and hearts, to answer the questions. But in any event, so the Ramban there says that the Jesus that the Jews are talking about lived almost 200 years before the Jesus that the New Testament is talking about. And that's based on the Talmud. The Talmud tells us that Jesus was a Talmud of Rabbi Yeshua ben Prachya. Rabbi Yeshua ben Prachya lived at the time of the Chashmonaim, the early Chashmonaim, the time of Hanukkah. Lived about 165 before the Common Era. The execution took place 35 after the Common Era, so it's 200 years. So it couldn't be the same person. So that, according to Ramban, even the references in the Talmud are not references to Christianity. They're not references to the Jesus of Christianity. They're references to a different person.
This is the end of side one. Please turn your tape over.